Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 12 in the German 6th Army and the 4th Panzer Armies at the gates of Stalingrad and about to enter the city, named after the Soviet dictator. As we heard last week, the 16th Panzer Division, which is part of the 6th Army, had already found its way into the northern suburbs, and frantic defense by the Russian Red Army had slowed their advance. In the south, the 4th Panzer Army had been held up at times by a fighting retreat by the Russian 62nd and 64th Armies, although there were increasing reports of Russian soldiers surrendering in large numbers. In response, NKVD commissars were told to start executing those caught running away. It's the first week of September 1942, and the autumn rains have already begun to fall, causing the Germans more difficulty. They are relying on the Luftwaffe, who are flying missions in support of ground forces, and the overcast conditions are proving to be a real problem. As the Wehrmacht draws closer to Stalingrad, the number of casualties are beginning to rise on both sides. Civilians are fleeing the city across the Volga River, while workers in the factories have formed up into battalions and will fight the German army in almost suicidal assaults in the coming weeks. The nearest parallel to this horrific battle was the mincing machine of Verdun in the First World War. But there are significant differences too. At Verdun, the contestants rarely saw each other face to face, being battered to death by high explosives or cut down at long range by machine guns. At Stalingrad, as we will see, each separate battle resolved itself into a combat, sometimes between individuals. It was personal. Soldiers would swear at each other inside different rooms in the same house and across streets. Often they would hear each other's breathing in the next room and hear the sound of tinkling of metal as the enemy reloaded their firearms. Hand-to-hand duels were finished in the dark as smoke and brick dust swirled about. Soldiers would kill each other with knives and pickaxes, clubs of rubble, and garrote others with wire or stab them with twisted steel. As Alan Clark writes in his great work called Barbarossa, fighting took place in a giant petrified forest of blackened chimney stacks, where defenders had little cover in the suburbs as the houses were built of wood which had burnt to the ground in the massive air raids of the 23rd of August. The Luftwaffe had pulverized the city, and as the Germans advanced, they would find the Russians would use these uneven iron, concrete and stone buildings to great effect. The sewers had become tunnels, and the Germans would soon have a name for this type of fighting inside Stalingrad, Rattenkrieg, rat war. By now, the Russians had moved most of their artillery across the Volga River to the east bank, where most of Stalingrad would still be in range, as the Germans would discover. The battle would also resolve tactically around control of the ferries, as there was no bridge across the mighty Volga River at Stalingrad. If the Russians could continue to send reinforcements into the city and provide them with ammunition, the Germans would find the going increasingly difficult, which is precisely what happened. One of the earliest Russian soldiers to arrive was a female radio operator called Private Nina Alexeyevna Semyonova. She enlisted straight out of school, but had still not fully grown when she arrived in Stalingrad.
"There was deadly combat going on there. It was the most deadly place. The water and the earth were red," she said.
A group of 80 women arrived at the east bank of the Volga, and they were not made welcome. Russian soldiers were shouting, "What, girls? Who the hell needs you here? We need riflemen and machine gunners, not radio operators." So of the 80 women and girls in the communication company by the first evening, most had been sent across the river. Nina was not one of these, as she looked too young.
"We were too small. We hadn't grown up,"
she told journalist Svetlana Alexievich in an interview in the early 1980s. Officers wanted to keep her in reserve, but she kicked up such a fuss the next day she was also sent over the Volga.
"In my first battle, the officers kept pushing me off the breastwork because I stuck my head up to see everything."
Her commanding officer screamed at her to get down and said she'd be killed.
"I couldn't understand how I could be killed," she admitted. "If I had only just arrived at the front, I didn't know yet how indiscriminate death is. You can't plead or argue with it."
And death was everywhere, particularly around the 16th Panzer Division, which had spent 5 days fighting against the factory workers of Stalingrad and had failed to reach the tractor plant where the all-important T-34 tanks were being produced. Back at the underground bunker of Tsaritsa Gorge, Russian Commander General Andrei Yeremenko was faced with an ugly truth. His motley collection of workers, old men and young women, had fought to the last on his right flank. He was also faced with the new terrifying reality that German 6th Panther Army General Papa Hoth had outwitted him. Hoth had pretended to pull his tanks back, then unleashed them towards Stalingrad, causing the panic I mentioned in episode 11.
Papa Hirth had unlocked the door to Stalingrad. And yet in the north, General Paulus reverted to dithering. His 6th Army was being harried by Soviet units, and the narrow salient meant he was afraid of one of his divisions being cut off. On September 2nd, General Paulus finally agreed to the southward drive towards Hoth, and within hours, the jaws of the pincers snapped shut. But Paulus had waited too long. Most of the Russian troops on the steppe had escaped back into Stalingrad, and those 72 hours of indecision had given the enemy another chance to fight. 20,000 Russian troops made their escape back to the city as Hoth seethed, joined, it must be said, by von Richthofen, the extremely aggressive Luftwaffe commander, who had his doubts about General Paulus. Zhukov had also just arrived in Stalingrad, sent to bolster the Soviet army leadership in the city. As I mentioned previously, Zhukov was a highly successful general who'd won major battles against the Japanese in Manchuria and the Germans the winter before outside Moscow in 1941 and early 1942. Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin was banking on the former peasant doing it all over again. On the 3rd of September, Stalin sent a telegram to Marshal Zhukov, who had travelled to Malaya Ivanovka on the western bank of the Volga, 50 miles north of Stalingrad.
"The situation has deteriorated further," went the telegram. "The enemy stands 2 miles from the city. Stalingrad may fall today or tomorrow if the northern group of forces does not give immediate assistance. Strike the enemy at once. No delay can be tolerated. To delay now is tantamount to a crime."
Stalin was always one to build his team's morale by threatening death or imprisonment, but Zhukov was a tough nut and hardly likely to crack under the dictator's bullying. It was also clear from Stalin's message the dictator was close to panic. In the 5 days that Marshal Zhukov had been at the front, he had failed to perform a single military miracle, yet he was more effective than his fellow commanders at coordinating Russian infantry attacks. He was extremely effective at using his meager air and tank units. Still, the Russian mincing machine kept churning out the casualty count. Zhukov knew that he needed another 2 weeks to build up his materiel and men and women to counterattack, but by then Stalingrad would have fallen. The Germans were beginning to count the cost as well. Adolf Hitler's gamble of splitting his great southern army had created a situation where neither the 6th Army nor the 1st Panzer Army in the south had enough power to overcome local Soviet resistance. In the Caucasus, Field Marshal List had warned he needed more men and equipment, but Hitler refused to accept that request. The problem was the Germans didn't have enough firepower in either Stalingrad or the Caucasus. On the 7th of September, General Alfred Jodl returned from a trip to the Caucasus to see things for himself. Hitler invited him to a dinner where he bemoaned Field Marshal List's slow advance. Jodl told Hitler that List had just been following the Führer's orders.
"That's a lie!" screamed Hitler, who then stormed out of the dinner.
Staff officers report at this point, the first week of September 1942, that Hitler appears to have been pushed over the psychological cliff in some way. One of these officers was General Volimont, who had been on leave, and when he returned to Hitler's HQ, he was shocked and spoke of Hitler's burning hate for the Russians, and indirectly for Stalingrad. Nicholas van Below, who was the Führer's Luftwaffe adjutant, also returned from leave and described what he called a completely new situation at Hitler's HQ. Hitler had suddenly become withdrawn. We also know now that Hitler was pretty much as high as a kite much of the time, receiving shots of what's known as methamphetamines. He had announced in May that a failure to take the Caucasus oil fields will mean the war would be lost. Now List's 1st Panzer Army had ground to a halt more than 100 miles from the main oil fields, and suddenly Hitler changed his tune. There was hope, and it was suddenly focused like a warped laser on Stalingrad. As long as Stalingrad was crushed, there was hope. At least, that's what Hitler fixated on. What was the real strategic aim of holding up half his southern army here? If it was so important, should he not immediately move 1st Panzer Army in the Caucasus back to finish off the defenders, then return to seize the oil fields? As Anthony Beaver writes, the dangerous dreamer had turned to symbolic victory for compensation. During the day of 4th of September, 6th Army's Allied Corps took Gumrak Station, which put it in position to attack into Stalingrad between Mamayev Hill and the Tsaritsa Gorge, where Yeremenko was based. The 4th Panzer Army was bearing down in Stalingrad in the south of the Tsaritsa Gorge, along the railroad east of Voroponovo, and from the southwest through Peshanka. Paulus gave General Seidlitz of the Allied Corps another infantry division and told him to attack downtown Stalingrad the next day, the 5th. It just so happens that was the same day chosen by Zhukov to launch his counterattack. At dawn on the 5th, Zhukov was at a 1st Guards Army observation post opposite the 4th Panzer Corps on the north front to watch the start of the counterattack demanded by Stalin. Zhukov was not happy to begin this so early and yet knew the Soviet army had to throw its last dice. The Germans were about to overrun the city. Moskalenko had been moving into his position since the 2nd of September and then had stopped to wait for the 24th and 66th armies to get into position on his left and right. General Malinovsky, who was leading the 66th Army after his front was disbanded, had told Moskalenko on the night of the 4th that in the morning he would be starting the attack piecemeal because half his divisions were still marching into position. Not ideal. The same was the case with General Kozlov, who commanded the 24th Army. He could not attack in large numbers. His men were also still marching in position, and he wouldn't be ready either. Consequently, the counterattack hinged mainly on 1st Shock Army, as it was known, which was the only one of the three that was fully deployed and the only one to have seen previous action. Yet the 1st Shock Army was not experienced enough to carry the other two along as it moved forward. This would become clear by the end of the day of the 5th of September. So the artillery and rocket barrages began at 0600, and Zhukov saw that the density of fire was low. He was frustrated by this. Without a concentration of firepower, the Germans were likely to survive virtually intact. And then they showered the assaulting Russian units with a firepower of their own, and Zhukov realized his counterattack was not likely to penetrate very far. The 66th Russian army joined the assault at 0900, and the 24th only at 1 p.m. By then, Moskalenko's divisions had been stopped by the Germans and were themselves being hit by counterattacks. Zhukov phoned Stalin, who told him to try another attack the following day, as the Russians had slowed the Wehrmacht and bought some time for Stalingrad. Stalin was more right than he knew. At midday of the 5th, Paulus had cancelled the Allied Corps attack into Stalingrad and had diverted all of 6th Army's air support to the north front. The 14th Panzer Corps cleaned up about half a dozen units and had a tight front again before dark, but in doing so, it had incurred large losses in both men and materiel.
"And a heavy expenditure of ammunition," Paulus read in a dispatch.
The 6th of September dawned, and once again, the poor Russian soldiers were ordered over the top. It was no better for Zhukov, but things were also getting worse for the German 14th Panzer Corps. Ground fog, which was common in early autumn, had prevented the Luftwaffe from providing ground support, and they were suffering huge losses. In the afternoon, Wittesheim of the 14th Panzer Corps called Paulus and told him his front was strained to the limit. He had to have more infantry and constant air support, even if it meant putting off the attack into Stalingrad indefinitely. But Wittesheim repeated that to enter Stalingrad without securing the northern front should not be considered a wise tactic. Paulus replied somewhat arrogantly that he knew Wittesheim's situation.
"Clearly and exactly."
But thought differently about how to handle it. He had the opposite idea. "First, Stalingrad must fall," Paulus said, "to free strength for the north front." Furthermore, Paulus added, the 14th Panzer Corps' mission was to hold out until Stalingrad fell. And so it was the Germans' turn to launch a major assault. The Allied Corps attacked at daylight on the 7th and in 14 hours stretched its line east to Razgulyayevka station, which was only 5 miles northeast of the strategically important Mamiev Hill. Seidlitz and his chief of staff went to the army command post the next morning with a proposal to drive into Stalingrad, or at least on the next, the 8th. But now Paulus ordered him to halt. Worse, Paulus was not entirely sure what he should do next. The German casualty list was growing fast, which unnerved him. The Russians were fighting like demons. In the north, the 16th Panzer Division's star commander, Count von Strachwitz, managed to hold out, although facing floods of Russian tanks and troops. He had a cool head and his men were far better trained, which was bad news for the T-34s heading towards him. While the Russian tank was far better than his Mark IVs, he could maintain a far higher rate of fire, which was deadly accurate. So the Russians sent in wave after wave of T-34s and the American Lend-Lease Sherman tanks. These had a high profile and thinner protection and proved easy to knock out. Their Soviet crews did not like them at all.
"The tanks are no good,"
said one driver captured by the Germans.
The valves go to pieces, the engine overheats, and the transmission is no use.
One of the German tank commanders, called Friedrich Loddenhoven, recounted what happened on the 7th as these waves of T-34s and American Shermans approached.
The Russians attacked over a hill, he said, and we were on the reverse slope. Over 2 days, they kept coming in exactly the same way, exposing themselves on the skyline.
More than 100 of these were destroyed, while a pioneer corporal wrote home later that,
as far as I could see, there were countless shot up and burned tanks.
It was such a major event and battle that the 49-year-old Slachwitz was honored with the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross and posted back to Germany soon afterwards. He was regarded, at 49, as too old to continue leading tanks into battle. He handed over command to Friedrich Loddenhoven. Still, General Paulus delayed as his flanks continued to be nipped at by the Russians. A diary kept by one of the Germans who'd exulted at the massive air raid on the 23rd of August indicates to some extent how frustrated the common German soldier had now become. On September 1st, he wrote,
"Are the Russians really going to fight on the very bank of the Volga? It's madness."
By the 8th of September, he was writing,
"Insane stubbornness."
By the 11th of September, he wrote,
"Fanatics."
Later in the month, as the Germans tried and failed to overrun the city, he would be referring to
wild beasts, barbarism, they are not men but devils, and later, they are barbarians, they use gangster methods.
Yes, we'll get to these gangster methods in later podcasts. In spite of some desertions, Russian resolve was firming by the day. They'd held off this large German army for 2 weeks, when Paulus and his commanders believed the attack should really only take a day or maybe two. The Russian counterattacks were appallingly wasteful and incompetent, but there is no doubt that they were determined to defend Stalingrad at any cost. This, while some desertion continued, so each sector and in each firefight and battle, there would be both cowardice and heroics. Each factory and even house would see different human responses to war played out. It was also at this moment the poem by Anna Gorenko, better known by her pen name Anna Akhmatova, was published.
"The hour of courage has struck on the clock,"
ran the line, which symbolized her people's fight against the German army in Stalingrad. For Yeremenko and Khrushchev, hunkered down in the Tsaritsa Gorge bunker, the main decision at this time was to choose a successor to the commander of the 62nd Army. It had fought its way back to the city by the 10th of September and was now cut off from the 64th Army to the south when the German 29th Motorized Infantry Division broke through to the Volga at Kuporoshnoye, at the southern tip of Stalingrad. More about that in a moment. Worse, the 62nd Army was an army in name only. It had been torn to shreds by the Germans as men fought a constant retreat. Naturally, the commander's nerve had failed. Paulus had reassigned Allied Corps to head northeast to mop up the remnants of Russian units stranded behind 14th Panzer Corps. Paulus was still in the throes of indecision about which units should head directly for the city and which should remain behind to protect the flanks and rearguard. For the time being, he said Hoth should not drive into Stalingrad because he was facing Soviet attacks to the south and taking strain. The advantage of a double thrust into the city would be lost anyway. On the 9th, the Allied Corps dutifully pushed northeast against an enemy which was
tenaciously defending every single bunker,
according to a dispatch. After meeting with Paulus's 6th Army on the steppe just south of the city, Papa Hoth's 4th Panzer Division's wheeled eastwards once again. Once he'd freed his flank from the attack, Hoth had a notable success on the morning of the 10th, when a battalion of the 29th Motorized Division reached the Volga, as I said, at the southern suburb of Kuporoshnoye. It immediately lost the half mile right up against the river during the night of the 10th when it was overrun by ferocious charges by the Russians from both north and south. This wild melee continued for the next 4 days as individuals on both sides fought like tigers for a tiny strip of land around Kuporoshnoye, which was to be the grave of many more thousands of men and women over the next 5 months. Ominously, gone were the lightning 10-mile advances. Now Hoth settled for only a mile or two each day. The panzers were bogged down in the narrow streets in the southern suburbs, where Russian soldiers would douse tanks with Molotov cocktails. From windows, snipers picked off entire squads of unwary German foot soldiers. Artillery was moved into the city by the Germans, and instead of blasting away at unseen enemy units miles away, it was now deployed to rip out the guts of buildings 50 yards in front of stalled German divisions. Things were getting more personal by the day. The cost was frightful on both sides, but for the Wehrmacht, more ominous. The Reich was fighting a war on so many fronts, with many demands for men and materiel. A corporal in the 71st Regiment of the 29th Motorized Division, by the name of Walter Hull, wrote in his diary that, "During this period, we were frequently without company commanders or even platoon leaders. Each one of us, this may be hard, but this was the way it was, could easily guess that he might be the next to go." Hull was one of the men who managed to make it to the Volga on the 10th of September at Kuporoshnoye, a day after their first warm meal in more than a week. The situation, though, was beyond critical for the defenders. Hull's battalion had isolated the 62nd, already cut off in the north by the German 6th Army. It was penned into a salient around the suburb of Bekatovka and faced the full weight of General Paulus's main body drawn up at the western rim of Stalingrad. A relatively small force of fewer than 20,000 men was the only combat force left to deny Stalingrad to more than 200,000 German invaders. Finally, as the Germans bombed his HQ, General Yeremenko was forced to move back across to the eastern side of the Volga. When Nikita Khrushchev phoned Stalin to explain why they wanted to leave, the dictator had fumed, "No, that's impossible. If your troops find out their commander had moved his headquarters out of Stalingrad, the city will fall." Khrushchev, though, was equally stubborn. The main argument he used was that the telephone cables to the units were being constantly cut by the heavy shelling, and on the east bank, they'd be in better control of their men. Eventually, Stalin realized Khrushchev and Yeremenko were correct.
"Well, all right, if you're certain that the front will hold, I'll give you permission."
The headquarters staff crossed the Volga on September 9th. Before leaving, Khrushchev called in the bald-headed General Golikov and told him to stay behind with the sacrificial 62nd Army commander, General Alexander Ivanovich Lopatin. Golikov turned white as a sheet and blurted,
"Stalingrad is doomed," he begged. "Don't leave me behind. Don't destroy me. Let me go with you."
Khrushchev told him to shut up and pull himself together, then stalked out of the bunker and caught a ferry to the far eastern shore. And now we'll halt to treat the wounded and prepare for a counterattack. Next week, we'll hear how the German 71st Division enters downtown Stalingrad on a 2-mile front. Russian snipers begin to make very merry indeed. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you have the time or the inclination. If you have any comments, you can contact me through the website, abwarpodcast.com, or direct message me on Twitter, @DesLatham. Until next week.